Good evening. Good evening and welcome to Dickinson College's celebration of Constitution Day. This is a particularly meaningful occasion for us this year. Beginning this evening, the college will also begin a year-long celebration of John Dickinson's 275th birthday. As many of you know, the college's founder, Dr. Benjamin Rush, chose to name our institution after his good friend, John Dickinson, who was then serving as governor of Pennsylvania. How appropriate it is that we are able to welcome our Commonwealth's First Lady, the Honorable Marjorie O. Rendell, as our speaker this evening. Dickinson College was chartered just days after the Treaty of Paris brought final conclusion to the Revolutionary War. Born out of revolution through the vision of Dr. Rush, Dickinson College was intentionally established to prepare the engaged citizens and leaders upon whom the new democracy depended. Rush instinctively knew that the new nation would only thrive through the active participation of its citizens that were educated in a manner far different from that offered in Europe. For Rush, a Dickinson education was to be rigorous, active, forward-looking, and above all, useful. It was to secure, through the active participation of its graduates, nothing less than the sustained success of a new democracy. Rush's vision of the mission of Dickinson College was, of course, given heightened significance in articulation when the Constitution was drafted several years later in 1787. This dynamic living document, which John Dickinson played such a prominent role in drafting, has served as the bedrock of our democratic society for over 200 years. Tonight, therefore, we gather to celebrate the principles and power of the dynamic document that serves us as the foundation of our country. We also gather to remind ourselves of the responsibility handed down to us through the vision of both Rush and Dickinson to perpetuate and strengthen our American democracy as informed and engaged citizens. It is an extraordinary legacy, and one that is as vitally relevant to the complex global environment of the 21st century as it was 220 years ago. Before I turn the podium over to our student presenter, I must mention Dickinson's direct connection to National Constitution Day. The first national grassroots commemoration of the Constitution took place across the country in 1993. With over 200,000 Americans of all ages partaking in events that featured historic figures, bunting, and bands. This effort was launched by the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia when Governor Ed Rendell was mayor. The individual who headed the center and this initiative was Dickinson College alumnus and trustee Robert M. Brassler. It is with great pleasure that we welcome Bob and his wife, Civi, back to campus this evening as we continue this wonderful tradition he initiated 14 years ago in the country. Bob, would you please ride, and Civi. At Dickinson, the coordination of the early concept of National Constitution Day celebration now over a decade ago was enthusiastically embraced by the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. The Clark Center, as it was then called, had been created specifically to address issues of contemporary import. It actively supported the effort to demonstrate how the Constitution continues to shape our daily lives. In 1994 and 95, the Clark Center fostered awareness of the Constitution Day on campus and in the community by sponsoring ceremonial signings of the Constitution, events in which over 2,500 citizens penned their names to giant parchment replicas of the Constitution. In 1996, the Clark Center continued its commemorative effort by initiating the annual Constitution Address at Dickinson. The Constitution Address, endowed through the generosity of Winfield C. Cook, former Dickinson College trustee, and his family, is presented each year by a prominent public figure on a contemporary issue relating to the Constitution. The event both celebrates the signing of the United States Constitution and commemorates the college's connection, direct connection to the document through John Dickinson's participation as an original signer. I would now like to ask Abby Hazen to come to the podium to introduce our distinguished speaker. Abby is originally from Southampton, Massachusetts, and is a member of the class of 2010. She is currently pursuing a major in history and law and policy, and a minor in anthropology. She is a member of the track and field team and a member of Earth Now. Abby served as a 2007 orientation assistant and is a student project manager for the Clark Forum. Now, Abby, I must say, I know this is one of those moments when you are probably thinking, is he going to take my speech with him as I lift this up? I want to assure you that your speech is still here. Abby?
Good evening. My name is Abby Hazen, and I'm student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum and the Department of Political Science, I'd like to welcome you to tonight's Constitution Day address, The Constitution and Civic Responsibility. On September 17, 1787, 39 men signed the U.S. Constitution, restricting and limiting the powers of the American government. As the oldest written democratic constitution in use, the United States Constitution stands for the protection of American citizens from the potential abuse of majority rule and cooperation. September 17, 2007, marked the 220th anniversary of the signing of the Constitution. This date serves as a reminder of the Founding Fathers' legacy and American citizens' responsibility to protect the rights which those 39 men presented over two centuries ago. Tonight's speaker, Judge Marjorie Rendell, is a judge for the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit and the 43rd First Lady of Pennsylvania. Judge Rendell's primary objective as First Lady is to impart public responsibility to the children of America through civic learning. She believes that America's children must understand and embrace the United States system of democracy. To understand the rights and responsibilities which come with democracy, American children must develop a shared concern for citizenship. Judge Rendell graduated with a bachelor's degree from the University of Pennsylvania and with a law degree from Villanova University School of Law in 1973. She joined the law firm of Duane Morris and Heckscher when she became the second female partner. During her 20-year law degree, Judge Rendell specialized in bankruptcy law and commercial litigation and served as a district court mediator. In March of 1994, she was inducted as Judge of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. In November of 1997, Judge Rendell was elevated to the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. She also serves as the chair of the United States Judicial Conference Committee on the Administration of Bankruptcy System, and serves on several Third Circuit committees. Judge Rendell is an elected member of the Federal Judges Association, the American Judiciary Society, and the National Association of Women's Judges. At this time, please turn off all cell phones and pagers. In addition, please hold any questions until the end of the presentation, when there will be a question and answer period. Since we are taping this event, and out of the courtesy of those who are hearing impaired, please wait for the microphone to reach you before asking your question. And now, please join me in welcoming Judge Marjorie Rendell.
Thank you, Abby. That was terrific. It was especially terrific because you made it your own. Sometimes when people introduce you, they read right off your biography. But I must say, Abby, you deserve a lot of credit. You didn't do that. So thank you. That made it very special. As has been noted tonight, on September 17th, we celebrated a historic moment in our nation's history. That is, it is Constitution Day. It's a moment that needs to be reexamined with the same American soul that first gave birth to it in May of 1787, when freshly spread dirt covered the cobblestone street in front of the Pennsylvania State House in Philadelphia to muffle sounds of passing carriages and carts. When delegates gathered, originally called to discuss interstate commerce issues and revise the Articles of Confederation, but instead gave birth to our Constitution. So within the confines of a small room, known today as Independence Hall, 55 delegates endured the sweltering heat and black houseflies to fashion words that breathed life into our Constitution. It was there that every possible individual objection and disagreement was discussed, but put aside in favor of a union of the states that would unite all in a common bond. It was there that our forefathers crafted a great document and pledged an oath of allegiance to maintain and preserve it for generations to come. And still today, their handiwork is intact. As this college commemorates the 275th birthday of John Dickinson, let it be a time to celebrate his freedom of thought and those actions that gave birth to this nation's voice of distinction. This college's father, John Dickinson, was a man guided by principle, analysis, learning, and experience, all of which were instrumental in the framing of our Constitution. He was one of the first to resist British encroachments upon American liberties and independence, and was called upon to act as spokesman for the colonists. Ever mindful of protecting and safeguarding our liberties under the law, his celebrity was won through his bellicose farmers' letters, wherein he spoke out against British taxation of the colonies and spoke out against the Parliament's right to legislate for the colonies in all cases whatsoever. As a framer of the Constitution, his discretion and persistence helped formulate an independent regime of limited government, outlined a plan for this nation's creative authority in the executive, that is, the Electoral College, and established a legislature represented by common elected people. Under the direction of our forefathers, men like Dickinson and Benjamin Rush, our historic past was guided by educated and experienced leaders, motivated by their quest to conserve and preserve our democratic society. Dickens once described our Constitution as ever new and always the same, an outcome of unity, of force, wisdom, and benevolence, and a product of history, not theory. He fully understood the need to promote wisdom as an important component for Americans' young citizens, making understanding the vehicle to preserve this document as distinctively unique. Our Constitution was crafted with great consideration for the welfare of we, the people, for perpetuity. It was a solid rejection of the dynamics of government that people left behind in England, the government of classes and the entitlement of the few. No one understood this better than George Washington, as is illustrated in his farewell address of 1796, when, with prophetic wisdom, he said, "You are Americans. You love freedom. Interwoven as is the love of liberty with every ligament of your heart, no recommendation of mine is necessary to fortify or confirm that attachment. It is of infinite moment that you should properly estimate the immense value of your national union to your collective and individual happiness, that you should cherish a cordial, habitual, and immovable attachment to it, accustoming yourselves to think and speak of it as of the palladium of your political safety and prosperity, watching for its preservation with jealous anxiety, discountenancing whatever may suggest even a suspicion that it can in any way be abandoned, and indignantly frowning upon the first dawning of any attempt to alienate any portion of our country from the rest or to enfeeble the sacred ties which now link together the various parts." The freedom of which Washington spoke is not an unbridled liberty. It is rather a freedom to exist in a democratic society where everyone enjoys the same rights and opportunities, and where the structure of government ensures a balance of power that lends stability. Thus, the concept of pursuit of happiness and domestic tranquility. No other country in the world was founded upon such principles. Our Constitution was devised to work for the individual and for the nation, and it does, and this is indeed special. As the newest custodial citizens of the 21st century, we must rededicate ourselves to the notion that we must be proficient in understanding our Constitution. We, the people, must understand and treasure the magic of a document that allows us to realize our rights within an enterprise of democracy that is buttressed by the rule of law. It is our duty as today's citizens to educate our youngest so that they not only know the words, We, the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our prosperity, do ordain and establish this Constitution of the United States of America, but rather understand the relevance of these words still today. This document is as much a moral document as it is intellectual. It is about living together and sometimes struggling together to sustain it. Our schools are a vital component in this mission. Civic duty and learning both have deep roots in America. In fact, preparing each new generation to be active participants in our democracy was a central reason for free public schools in the new republic. And our schools must provide that civic peace. That is the vehicle needed to drive the development of constitutional understanding and sustainability. Without concentration on citizenship in our schools, without providing the pedagogic school tools of democracy, without an engaged young citizenry, our Constitution will fail. In recent years, the importance of this understanding as an aspect of education appears to have been lost its luster and its urgency. Until the 1960s, three courses in civics and government were common in American high schools. Two of them, Civics and the Problems of Democracy, explored the roles of citizens and the relationship of government to the people and encouraged students to discuss current issues. But today, these courses are sometimes rare in our schools. What remains are courses on American government that focus more on facts and less on the how and why of a participatory government and active citizenship. But thankfully, there is a broad national movement currently underway to restore the civic mission of our nation's schools, and every citizen must play a vital role in that undertaking. Whether we're students, teachers, parents, or just observers of our educational system, the civic mission of our schools must be encouraged and supported. Today, we live in a time of challenges to our society, where democracy and our very way of life are being tried and tested by outside forces, making it imperative for us to truly understand who we are and how we function as a people and a nation. We, as Americans, must counter the movement towards a disengaged and distracted nation that would rather be entertained than informed. We cannot let our young citizens think that the relative prosperity they enjoy in this country is a birthright. Instead, we must help them understand that our orderly society values the rule of law and consequently spawns economic opportunity, again enabling the pursuit of happiness. It is not enough to simply tell our high school students that they should vote or get involved in public issues or do community service. We must help them understand at the earliest possible moment that democracy only functions properly when the people are aware of their responsibility to voice their views, act thoughtfully, and reject the inclination to consider only a candidate's debate style or attire or expensive haircut, rather than focusing on a meaningful agenda or a platform that challenges current policy. We have to teach our youngest citizens that participatory government requires the thoughtful contribution of each and every one of us. This is the responsibility we all share and the debt we all owe for the rights we enjoy. More than ever before, we're tasked with the responsibility to maintain the republic and sustain it within a world that is structured differently. We should be proud of being Americans, but it must be an informed pride, born of an American soul and an active citizenry. Ringing true are Benjamin Franklin's words to a curious woman upon leaving the Constitutional Convention in September of 1787, when she asked, "What kind of government have you given us, Dr. Franklin?" To which he replied, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it. And keep it we must through education." I suggest that today's teaching of government and citizenship must encompass more than an acquisition of content knowledge. It can teach the who, what, and when of historical facts, but it must further question through experiential learning, the why of historical significance. Today's students can read, but are they taught to reflect? We need to develop leaders who can think, analyze, and propose solutions that come not from rote learning, but from the development of pragmatic discourse problem-solving, and critical thinking skills. We cannot simply teach our young citizens what the First Amendment says. We must help them understand that free speech and the absence of censorship is the very foundation of a free society, as much today as in 1787. We cannot simply tell them that there are three branches of government that operate with checks and balances. We must help them understand that our three-pronged government, with executive, legislative, and judiciary, functions in a remarkable way to maximize the open representative character and conduct of government, giving some power to the people, yet balancing that power with adherence always to the rule of law. As a federal judge and First Lady of the Commonwealth, I am advocating for a renewed civic mentality through education. This has resonated with me, as it should with all of us, not merely because I am a federal judge or First Lady, but because I am a citizen, first and foremost. I'm one of the lead advocates in a shared venture known as PennCord, the Pennsylvania Coalition for Representative Democracy. And it is our mission to work together as educators, students, parents, and community organizations to renew the civic mission of our schools. It is no longer enough to teach the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. Today, we must teach the five R's, combining reading, writing, and arithmetic with civic rights and responsibilities, in order to lay that strong foundation enabling our children to become true citizens of the world. Only then can we truly share our democracy, when it is understood that it is a gift that one must treasure and maintain if it is to be safeguarded. As Justice Sandra Day O'Connor has said, knowledge about the ideas embodied in the Constitution and the ways in which it shapes our lives is not passed down from generation to generation through the gene pool. It must be learned anew by each generation. It's not enough simply to read or memorize the Constitution. Rather, we should try to understand that which gave it life and that which gives it strength still today. Our understanding today must go beyond the recognition that liberty lies in our hearts to the further recognition that only citizens with knowledge about the content and meaning of our constitutional guarantees of liberty are likely to cherish those concepts. Some of what I'm saying about the appreciation of the Constitution might seem commonplace, but I must tell you that as a federal judge, the realization and the impact of citizenship came to me when I was presiding over a naturalization ceremony on the 3rd of July, several years ago, in the shadow of Independence Hall, and looking out on the faces of the new citizens who had come from all over the world to become citizens of the United States, it struck me. This doesn't happen everywhere or anywhere else in the world. The United States is special. And it was amazing to me that it took until I was a federal judge to have this moment and this epiphany. And I must tell you that Justice Souter, one of our wonderful justices of the Supreme Court, related a story where he had a similar epiphany just last year. And he was reminded of taking a Russian lawyer through the Supreme Court. And they were exchanging stories about Supreme Court opinions. And he asked the lawyer, "How do you know so much about our United States Supreme Court?" And the man replied, "Well, during the Cold War, some friends of mine and I decided that every time we would get an opinion from the Supreme Court of the United States, we would share it and discuss it." And the lawyer asked Justice Souter, "What do you think is the most important opinion that the Supreme Court has issued since the Supreme Court building was built in 1935? And without hesitation, Justice Souter said, "Brown versus Board of Education." And the lawyer was obviously very disappointed in this response. And so Justice Souter, "Well, all right, what do you think was the most important opinion?" And the man replied, "The Nixon tapes case." Because that was the case in which a court of a country held that the executive of the country could be held to the rule of law as determined by a court. And Justice Souter marveled at that. And at the conference that he was attending, telling this story, he said, it hit him as an epiphany, as a remarkable moment as a justice of the United States Supreme Court. And he said to himself, "We don't teach civics anymore. And that was his bottom line of this story, that he realized we need to impart to our young people how amazing and how wonderful our Constitution really is. We are challenged, and yet we should be invigorated to teach this young generation of citizens who they are. They are the democracy of tomorrow, if not today. And this is a challenge that we cannot ignore. We must embrace it. As Kofi Annan reminds us, no one is born a good citizen. No nation is born a democracy. Rather, both are processes that continue to evolve over a lifetime. A society that cuts off from its youth severs its lifeline. But how can we meet this challenge? We can meet it together. Initially, we must view an American education as incomplete unless civic learning is fully integrated with normal academic tools, not as peripheral to the curriculum, but as a vital component in the comprehensive education of our youth from the earliest formative years. Just as other core values of family, community, and religion are taught, so too the values of citizenship must be instilled early on. The objective of civic learning cannot merely be to achieve a grade or pass a test, but instead it must focus on understanding concepts and relationships, and most importantly, to develop skills that will produce good citizens, one who can critically think and problem solve. I was addressing a group of superintendents from around the Commonwealth the other day, and we were talking about how to make sure that citizenship education got into our schools. And one of them talked about the fact that, like everything else, it needs to be measured. And if we can find a measure of citizenship in our schools and how we can measure it, just like we measure reading and math, then we can make sure that it can be put into the schools. And I said to them, well, that may be fine with math and with reading, but citizenship is something that's going to develop over time. What we want to produce is not people who can answer fact questions, but we want people who can critically think, and that will happen eventually, that they are critical thinkers, that they're analytic, and they have good judgment. So please, let's not wait until we can measure, and let's not measure facts and figures. Let's be sure we're doing the right thing by teaching, knowing that the results will come long after, but the results will be worth the teaching. No doubt today's young citizens are very knowledgeable about all the issues. And if asked what concerns them about the world, they will no doubt have responses. They're worried about terrorism, about the ozone layer and global warming, AIDS and racism, saving the environment, oil and gas reserves, war and the proliferation of nuclear weapons. They've heard about these things, but in an abbreviated manner, without much discourse or problem-solving methodologies. They must be encouraged to study, investigate, and explore all of these issues as a normal part of their learning experience. Through this approach, the topics and questions that arise will foster critical thinking skills and inspire young people to reflect on and become actively involved in developing solutions that will not only bind them to their communities, but will make their communities better. Citizenship is not a discrete subject. It is the key to a robust educational experience. John Dewey, an early educational reformer, firmly believed that both educational knowledge and skills must be fully integrated into the person, the citizen, and the human being. He believed that the nature of education must dramatically change if we are to make a difference as human beings living in a social world, and that in doing so, we can generate a responsible citizenry, interdependently preserving the earth for future generations. In his words, and I quote, "As a society becomes more enlightened, it realizes that it is responsible not to transmit and conserve the whole of its existing achievements, but only such as make for a better future society. The school is the chief agency for the accomplishment of this end," end quote. In closing, let me tell you a short story about John Dewey. A zealous school reformer, wearied by jousting with the status quo, heard about a spiritualist who was able to make contact with the dearly departed. So one evening, he went to one of her seances, and when his turn came, he said he wanted her to make contact with John Dewey. After struggling for a while, she reached Mr. Dewey. The reformer was thrilled. "Professor Dewey," he said, "we have labored for 15 years to improve America's schools without success. Please tell me, how can we create the kinds of schools our children need and deserve?" Dewey hesitated a moment and replied, "Well, there's the natural way, and then there's the miraculous way. Which do you want?" The reformer wasn't quite sure, but said, "What's the natural way?" "The natural way," Dewey said, "would be for God to send down bands of angels and visit every single school and transform them into places of true learning." "Good heavens," gasped the reformer. "Well, then, what's the miraculous way?" "Ah," said Dewey, "the miraculous way would be for the people to do it themselves." Conceived in liberty, democracy is our legacy to keep, and together we can reclaim it and our Constitution and civic learning for a broader purpose. We, the people, must do it ourselves. Our democracy, one of the people, by the people, and for the people, will survive one generation to another only if we earnestly cherish our greatest responsibility, that of citizen, and share with our children the deep sense of purpose in those words, "We, the people." Thank you. And now, before taking questions, I would ask President Durden to come up. We have a special proclamation from the governor in light of this august, and I do mean august, occasion. We even have a gold seal here, and we don't part with gold very easily in Harrisburg, I have to tell you. So it's my pleasure to read this proclamation and present it to President Durden on behalf of the governor. To John Dickinson, it is my distinct pleasure to join with everyone in attendance at Dickinson College on this Constitution Day to wish John Dickinson a very happy 275th birthday. Born on November 2, 1732, John Dickinson was elected and served in both the Delaware Assembly and the Pennsylvania Assembly. As he served as a delegate to the Stamp Act Congress and the Continental Congress, he authored numerous petitions, declarations, and addresses, including the first draft of the Articles of Confederation. He was elected president, governor of Delaware in 1781, and president, governor of Pennsylvania in 1782. We won't get into what happened in Delaware, making him leave so quickly and coming to Pennsylvania, but he ended up in Pennsylvania. In 1783, John Dickinson allowed Benjamin Rush to have Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, named for him. It was the first college in the nation west of the Susquehanna River and was named in his honor. John Dickinson was a representative to the United States Constitutional Convention, was a signer of the Constitution in 1787, and subsequently authored the Letters of Fabius to encourage others to ratify the Constitution. As a successor to John Dickinson as Governor of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, I do hereby celebrate the many contributions of John Dickinson as a patriot and founding father of the United States of America, and also recognize the college named in his honor. Congratulations on Constitution Day. Edward G. Rendell, Governor, September 24th, 2007. Thank you, President.
Thank you.
Okay. And mindful of Abby's instructions, I'd be happy to take questions from the floor and would ask questioners to wait for the microphone. Oh, I'm so happy there are no questions. You're all just going out to promote civics education immediately.
Just relating to the First Amendment, the freedom of the speech, what's your opinion of the president of Iran visiting Columbia University today and giving his little speech?
Well, with all due respect, it's an excellent question. As a judge, I don't give advisory opinions. and I will tell you, one of the things of the role of a judge is that we try to maintain our independence from, you know, political or advocacy issues, which makes it very interesting for a first lady who's trying to adopt, you know, a certain cause or something that I can do outside of my day work, which is why I really picked citizenship education, because I think it is a fairly objective thing for us all to be working on. But since that question gets into the realm of, you know, is this a good or a bad thing from a world perspective. It does get a little bit on the the advocacy side, but from a free speech standpoint, the idea is broadening of ideas, and I think one of the things the founders had in mind was a proliferation of ideas. And if you believe in that, then any kind of sharing of ideas that is not disruptive. We do draw the line in the First Amendment to things that are disruptive and create disorder. But, you know, the idea of people speaking out and assembling is something that we value in this country. So as a matter of free speech, perhaps everyone should have the ability to go where they want, visit whom they want, and have people take sides. I presided over a naturalization ceremony on Constitution Day at the National Constitution Center, and I introduced Liz Cheney, wife of the vice president, and as she got up to speak, there were hecklers in the audience, but it wasn't that disruptive. They yelled a few things and then sat down, and she stood up and right off the bat said, well, that's what's wonderful about our country and our Constitution, free speech. They have a right to their opinion. So as long as people are expressing opinions, and contributing to the proliferation of ideas, however someone may find the ideas distasteful, that's really what our country was founded upon. There was some controversy a few years ago when one of the universities, and I forget which one, whether it's University of North Carolina, that seems to ring a bell, had as the entry reading, required reading for freshmen, a book having to do with the Koran. And there was a great hue and cry about that as being, you know, contrary to our national security or whatever. But others spoke up and said, proliferation of ideas, and others got up and said, it's really good that we understand what other people are thinking so we can think more broadly. So I think there are pros and cons of that kind of visit depending upon your viewpoint, but from a free speech viewpoint, it would seem that the proliferation of ideas without disruption is something that is fostered by the First Amendment.
Hello. You mentioned in your speech the need that we need to teach civic responsibility.
Yes.
But typically, even for like a presidential election, voter turnout's 50%.
Right.
Even our own student government elections on campus, around
50%. Right.
How do you get across to people that their voice matters, that their vote counts, and that they really can have a say in what goes on in our country?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because my view is that if we teach our young people from the earliest time of their education that they may be 4 foot tall, they may be blonde, they may have brown eyes, they may be in this family, this community, and above all, they are a citizen of this country, and that carries with it certain responsibilities, that we instill in our children this understanding of who they are and have them identify with it. I think one of our problems in our educational system is we come upon our students in sophomore and junior year in high school and all of a sudden say, you have to care about this. You have to care. It's part of you. You have to vote. And the reaction is, well, you know, I don't get it. I'm busy. We need to instill the value system early on of citizenship, just like, as I said, family, community. It's who you are. It's part of who you are. And I think that's the way, so that by the time they arrive at the age when they vote, there is no question but that voting is part of who they are, and it's part of their responsibility, and it's not something they have to do. It's something like, you know, attending a family reunion, or attending a community meeting where everyone is going. It's something that is basically a no-brainer because it's instilled in them. And, you know, there's also a variation on citizenship education these days, which is character education. And it's along the same lines, teaching responsibility, teaching children not to exercise power without authority, not to create, conflict unless they have a way of resolving it. And these types of educational systems have been shown to help students not only in terms of understanding who they are as citizens, but help in terms of their studies, improvement in achievement, in discipline. So I think the issue is broader than just I want people to appreciate the Constitution. I want our citizens to understand, as I look out on those new citizens that are being naturalized, the joy and the understanding in their faces of what they have just become by taking this oath. I think we should get our children excited about it so that later on we don't have to convince them and arm twist them and put this heavy duty responsibility on them that we haven't explained quite where it's coming from.
Yes, I have a question. In taking the civic mission and instilling this idea of citizenship in our students at a very young age, do you see that the next step then would be actually creating a national service of a community service program, something like the AmeriCorps, but taking it on a much more broad national basis where after we've taught our students throughout their secondary education that we ask them to do a one-year or two-year service in the larger community sense? How do you feel that plays
into it? That's interesting. I haven't thought that far ahead, but you know, thinking out loud, perhaps they would come naturally as an outgrowth, and perhaps it wouldn't come from us saying we're going to create it. Perhaps it would come from the youths themselves when they get to that point saying, before going to college, I want to contribute 2 years to service, and I want to take an active role, and then I'll go to college, or you know, during college doing more. So maybe I envision it as being something that would be, again, a natural outgrowth of the education process and would be a, you know, obviously a terrific outgrowth, that kind of service is something that they feel on their own they want to do, kind of like a mission. So I think the idea of enforcing and forcing our youth to do things at a certain age doesn't work as well as having it come from within. And I think a lot of the things I hear about service learning, and obviously the two are related, citizenship and service learning and the community service. I talk a great deal to high school seniors about when we have been able to put these education programs in, telling them what has worked and what hasn't. And they get very upset when the service learning in their high school is treated as a just get your 40 hours in. We don't care. Just get your 40 hours in as compared to share with us what you are learning. We really don't care about, you know, putting down your hours, but tell us what you're learning and how you're profiting from this. And the students themselves resent the fact that the administrations are not understanding that the students are getting a lot out of it that they want to impart, and all the administration wants, and this isn't universal, but when I've heard complaints, you know, is tell me you've done the numbers. So we as adults are contorting and, you know, really acting in a way that's counterintuitive to what they think they should be getting out of it and what they think we should realize they're getting out of it. So I think if it's a groundswell from our citizenry, from our young citizenry, that would be the best way. Yes.
Hi. I really enjoyed your call to arms for civic involvement. But one of my concerns was when you discussed a renewed sense of civic responsibility. Perhaps civic courses have been taken out of the curriculum, but at the same time, up into the 1960s, we had white communities intimidating black voters. And so I wonder if you look in the past, if you're putting it on a pedestal and maybe not a renewed sense of civic responsibility, but just a new commitment towards civic responsibility.
I'll go with that. That's fine. If that works, whatever works. Okay. Well, and I think the other thing, the renewed aspect of it is that many of us who have, you know, who wear eyeglasses and, you know, have gray hair, et cetera, learned civics in grade school. It was kind of like a catechism. We did understand civics, and it was part of our curriculum, and yet it has gone out of the curriculum. So the concept of renewal is to get it back in the schools. But I agree with you. I think the commitment now is entirely different. I mean, back then it was a nice commitment. Now we really need to value our democracy as a matter of priority in the world in which we live. The threat that we face, I mean, I hear about a war on terror. We are facing war on our way of life. It is our democratic way of life that is being threatened, that is being undermined, and that people are speaking out against our government and democracy. I mean, they're fighting against democracy. So it's not just, wouldn't it be nice if everyone understood about citizenship? In this day and age, there's a renewal, but there has to be a new invigoration because of what we face. And I think that is an interesting point, that it's the renewal of the curriculum aspect, but it's a very different topic than it was 40, 50 years ago, for sure. Yes.
I wonder if you could speak to the issue of civil rights and the relationship of civil rights to civic awareness of the Constitution. The lady raised a point related to that. I just wonder if you have, as a federal judge, you see a lot of cases, you read a lot, and in our enthusiasm for the Constitution, what relationship should civil rights and the history of civil rights law bear to that?
Well,
I know that's a complicated question, but
it's complicated, and yet, in essence, it gets back to what it is all about. The guarantee of civil rights is the guarantee of equality and the equal treatment of all, regardless of race, gender, national origin. And that's really what the Founding Fathers wanted to do. They were rejecting the system in England of power to those who were born of power and at lack of power for everyone else. And so the opportunity for the equality and the fact that we sit in a room and we turn to the left and the right and we say we're all equal under law in this country, and that is guaranteed. The civil rights movement and all the civil rights legislation has been to further that and to mandate what is in the Constitution. Now, obviously, that is an oversimplification because, you know, civil rights acts and civil rights lawsuits, et cetera, it gets complicated. But when you think of civil rights and when you hear about our country going to another country and saying we really have a problem with the way you are governing because you do not respect civil rights. That's really what it's all about. Our court gets appeals from the Board of Immigration Appeals, which, as I'm sure you understand, sits and decides about asylum and allowing people to stay in this country because of the Convention Against Torture. And very often we get state reports on other countries. And we don't realize how much torture and how widespread denial of civil rights is in the rest of the world. I mean, maybe we hear about it in extreme situations, but it's prevalent. And you come to this country, it isn't prevalent. If it exists, it exists in spite of the law. But if the law hears about it, the law puts it down. The rule of law will not countenance, will not permit violation of civil rights to exist. And we are active in that in a way that just isn't, that doesn't exist anywhere else. So it has become the hallmark of our society. I don't know if I've answered your question. It is a little complicated, but...
Piggybacking on the anecdote that you relayed about Justice Souter, what would you say you feel is your most important Supreme Court decision?
Oh, that's interesting. Brown versus Board of Education was extremely important and interesting because it was a unanimous decision wherein the justices adopted an interpretation of equality that had not existed before, and in doing so, did so regardless of the upheaval that it would cause. And as a judge, in the scheme of things, that was very, very important. Judges are criticized for giving into, you know, partisan political views or their own biases or agenda. And judges, by and large, do not do that. Judges are independent so that they are free to do the right thing, to do what the rule of law requires, no matter what. And if it's a difficult case, all the more that you need to adhere to the rule of law. And it takes courage. And those justices were very courageous. But they did what had to be done. There was a lack of equality. Separate wasn't equal, and they couldn't gloss over that fact. And reading Justice Douglas' conference notes on the conferencing, and there were several arguments and re-arguments in that case. It was tough, but they did what they felt was right and what the law required. So as a judge, and also from the standpoint of society as well, and what it means in this country, what our courts mean, that really was very, very important in the scheme of things. I could think of some others probably, but... And the enforcement, the cases that came after Brown versus Board that enforced the integration in schools, very, very important in our society.
We have time for one last question.
My question feels trivial compared to that one, but in your speech you mentioned that we need to give the schools, you know, teach now and measure later, but clearly the focus in schools today is ever stronger standards and more rigorous examinations, you know, to prove compliance, both with No Child Left Behind and so forth. So how do we carve out that space for the schools to teach a love of civics and to inspire in our youth a desire to explore more on their own and to build an enthusiasm for civics, as opposed to what I would guess the schools are likely to do is say, okay, add it to the standards test and I'll teach the exam.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I'd say there's two answers to that. To those who are hung up on the measurement, I would venture to say, and this has been proven at least a few areas where they have measured, that the scores in the tested areas do improve. And that has been shown. In Allentown, the Ritter Elementary School is in a very tough area. You know, the reading and math scores were down and the discipline problems, and they started a very rigorous citizenship education as the core of the curriculum. And then the subjects were, you know, kind of surplusage. The whole idea was understanding responsibility, understanding authority, understanding privacy, understanding these things. And the scores went up in other areas and the discipline improved. And so if you want to measure, let's measure impact in other ways and make sure we understand where it's coming from. But the other thing I'd say is areas where the youngsters, first, second grade, have learned these skills and been challenged to hear their voice. At this superintendent's meeting, I referred to one of the superintendents from Lancaster County was saying that she had witnessed a presentation by these students, these second graders who had been taught, and they were so excited, and they were so proficient, and they were just so thoughtful, and they understood concepts, and they were teaching their parents, that everyone got so excited about it, that it's almost like you say, well, it probably takes a little more effort to develop the curriculum, probably takes a little more effort on the part of the teachers to do, but wow, isn't this great? So that's what we have to do, and I've been thinking about actually trying to produce some videos of these presentations by youngsters to show them in other schools, because it isn't easy. One of the problems with the citizenship education is that you can't teach in a catechism anymore. You've got to give experiential, multidisciplinary, computer-friendly, so that the kids will go, wow, this is fun, I'm having a great time. Or else we're maybe not going to get there. But the kids are saying this is fun, I'm having a great time. So what we need to do is replicate these programs and let the measurement be how happy are our kids, how happy are the parents, how happy are the teachers, are we producing, you know, children who come to school you know, happy they're there. And it seems that this focus has been able to do that in the areas where it's been tried. So that would be my answer to that. Thank you. Oh, do you get a question, Bob? I'm not sure. I think trustees get questions. Or oh, good question. All right.
I'm going away. Well, for those who haven't, one way to encourage learning about the Constitution and what it means to be an American is to come to the Constitution Center and bring your friends and bring your family and tell people about it. Because I think you'll find it's a great experience.
Yeah.
Your husband was one of the
he loves the place. He loves. Thank you, Bob. Thank you for that plug. I must say that in my Penn Court initiative, National Constitution Center is one of my lead partners, and they have people who are working with me day in, day out on this. So while I'm doing my judge thing, they're working on it, and I couldn't do it without them. And it is just an amazing resource. For those who haven't gone, go. For those who have gone, go again. They have constantly new things happening and classes and all kinds of wonderful programs that help all of us be better citizens. What could be better? And Bob, thank you for your service in that regard, because you were there at the very beginning when everyone was saying, I mean, there are a lot of naysayers saying it can't happen, it shouldn't be done, why would we do it here? I love the ones that said, why would we do it in Philadelphia? So where else would we do it? I don't know. Anyway, well, thank you. You've been a terrific audience. I appreciate this.
Clark Forum in Dickinson College, we'd like to present this plaque as appreciation for Dickinson.
Thank you. And you, for all of you who didn't know, Abby designed this poster. I have a few ideas. I need some posters to design for my civics education initiative. You think I can call on Abby to help? Isn't it lovely? Thank you very, very much. I appreciate it.